This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to John O'Brien. He's the founder of Review of Contemporary Fiction and Dalkey Archive Press, as well as another magazine called Context. And I would say this is again, one of a series of conversations I've been having with editors and publishers whose work has been in literary publishing. Hi, John. How are you?
All right. How are you, David?
I'm very well. So you started, when you go back, the beginning was Review of Contemporary Fiction, which I think was 1980. Is that correct?
That's right.
And what were you doing at that time? What is your background? Were you, are you an academic person? Were you teaching at that point?
Yes, I was teaching full time, which meant four courses a semester, and I was also the department head.
And
starting the review under those circumstances were, let's say, difficult.
But you did this as part of your. You started this magazine as a journal of criticism, literary criticism. You were spurred by your feeling, I think, at that time that people whose work you appreciated and loved were not being written about. Is that correct?
Yes, you could say that it was a very selfish reason that the writers I was most interested in. I didn't know anybody else who was reading them, and I thought there must be at least one or two people out there who were reading the same people, and I wanted to know what they had to say about writers like Wallace Markfield, Douglas Wolfe, and Gilbert Sorrentino. So in many ways, it was even if it was going to be a very small group, to start the conversation about these writers, and most of them had not had any kind of criticism written on them at all, with the exception of maybe book reviews, but they're completely being ignored in the review media. And many of them had their books out of print. So it was really a vacuum for me in terms of what else, what do people have to say? Are there any critics out there who are interested? So it was more or less putting an MS in the bottle, sending it out. And the first person who found the bottle and responded was Robert Creeley, who said that he would write a piece for the first issue.
And how did you connect with Creeley?
Somehow or other, I came across his address. Somebody must have given it to me. And I'd been reading Creeley, of course, for years. And I assumed that there was a connection with Gill. Or perhaps I even knew it. So I was writing to him. That was the first letter I wrote asking somebody to write for the issue. And he agreed to do it, generous as he always was, especially with startup kinds of things. And he wrote an essay on Sorrentino's, I think it was Steelwork, or he just referred vaguely to a certain scene in Sorrentino, and he got it completely wrong. He combined something out of one book with something out of the other. And that the essay was published as it was, because I found that even interesting, that said something about reading, that we do tend to start to have all things swimming together with certain writers. So what he had to say was very interesting. The fact that he thought he was talking about just one book, and in fact he's talking about two, I found that interesting as well.
So did you see yourself in that sense as changing the discussion, and I guess I'm thinking that, it didn't seem that there was an academic interest in those writers at that time, although there must have been some, I'm sure there were some professors who were and academics who were interested in, even then in Black Mountain. And certainly there were people who had been part of that group who were then teaching. But did you feel like you were trying to establish a different dialogue, to bring criticism in a different direction?
Yeah, I wanted to blow up everything. The academics weren't teaching these writers, and I never came across any who were reading them, at least up to that point. And they certainly weren't writing about them. There was no future for a young academic to be doing a dissertation or even an MA thesis on someone like Gilbert Sorrentino. He wasn't recognized in academia as having any weight. So much more beneficial to you in your future if you did the 50th dissertation on Saul Bellow or John Updike than to take a writer like Sorrentino. In fact, I had a letter from somebody, maybe a year after that issue came out, thanking me. She was going to work on her MA, I think it was, at New York University. And she said she'd been trying to get her MA thesis approved. And she couldn't because there wasn't a body of criticism already available on the writer. So it's a nice academic way of making sure nobody gets into the circle that they've formed. And so she's able to get it approved because that issue came out. And that happened with some of the other writers that we were doing at that time, like Paul Metcalf and Douglas Wolf. It was only because these issues were being published and there was now a body of criticism that could be pointed to. But it was really all the project was a way of saying, you're all wrong. So the academics were wrong. The New York Times, which is always wrong, which they were today, once again, they gave a short review to our collected short fiction of John Barth. So it should have been a monumental kind of event in publishing in the U.S. Now, I know Barth doesn't occupy the same position that he did years ago, but this is, kind of summary statement of his work and collecting it, bringing it all together. And it's a short review. He shared the space with the review of William Gass's latest book. So both of them wound up getting short reviews, which is, of course, says something about the wonders of the New York Times.
Well, but so at least they got reviewed. That's today. That's a big deal.
That's yes. But Sorrentino's work from the very beginning was getting these short reviews, and when he started off, he's getting published by the commercial publishers, and even that the Times didn't know what to make out of him. So the review was a statement of you're all wrong, you're all doing it wrong. Here are the writers who are important. And I mapped it out for 5 years because I assumed it had to be a failure. And I based it, the form of it, and maybe even inspired by a magazine that you probably remember called Vort, which came out of Indiana, of all places. And Vort must have done maybe 20 issues altogether, and it went the way that those kinds of magazines usually do, ran out of money and was exhausting, and so it ceased to exist. And that's what I more or less was planning on for the review, that its end was already built into its beginning. But it didn't happen. I worked very hard to get subscribers to it and was able to get a fair number of them. That was floating the magazine. Now, I was the only person doing it, and so there was no overhead really associated with it, except for printing, and no writers were paid anything to be in it. So it was really an attack upon the state of books, publishing taste, aesthetics at the time, and it's a battle that still goes on.
So you started thinking that it would be like many other, and in fact, most literary magazines of that era, kind of expressive of a, energy and a field of interest, and then, expect to move on as, many magazines came and went. But, it is unusual for you to have been around this long. So it's now 35 years.
Yeah.
And now it's, of course, part of a much larger entity because you started publishing books as well. So just sticking with the review just a little bit longer, do you feel that the review of contemporary fiction has changed significantly over that period of time, or has it maintained its kind of singularity of vision and focus, but simply continued on doing work with different writers, but with the same purpose and approach?
Oh, it's an interesting question. we had to change it in some ways because I was running out of writers who fit this description and were also doing the kind of work that I was really interested in. So given that I had planned it for only 5 years and now it's clearly going on, we had to start finding other writers who were going to be fitting in. And we had to also turn to academics who by that time had become quite acquainted with the review because it really was having an impact and was rather widely read. And so we began doing longer essays rather than having an entire issue focus on the writer's work. So it changed in that way. And then it started becoming a bit too academic for my taste. And so we've changed it several times since. Many of the issues have been devoted to publishing fiction from writers living in countries that get no attention paid to them in the United States or in England. And so that was quite a departure from the scholarly, but really semi-scholarly nature of the review. As often as possible in those early years, I was having writers do the criticism. I wasn't turning to the academics or the professional critics. And in the first 5 years of it, it's really remarkable, the writers who were willing to volunteer to do essays where they were getting not paid at all, but they all kind of bought into the idea that here's a journal that's devoted to writers like themselves. But it survived. It survived. Maybe it survived too long, where the form of it could no longer continue to exist in the way that I'd started off. I think it's also mellowed. Those early years was the issues were filled with a lot of anger and maybe venom, and which I had planned on. I'd really wanted to name it after something by Wyndham Lewis, and or certainly in that spirit. But then I finally also thought I'd like to have people reading it in libraries subscribing to it, so I better not have a cute name for it. So I named it what it was, and. But it still took these very strong positions on a lot of different subjects that were related to not just literature, but what surrounds literature. So the state of the industry, for instance. There was one issue that was in the early 90s, maybe 93, that David Foster Wallace and I had put together. And this is before he was David Foster Wallace. And it was an attempt to project what fiction was going to be like in the future. And it was an interesting experience. As I say, he hadn't yet gotten the fame that he achieved, well, probably within a year after that came out. Infinite Jest had not been published yet. And a number of the writers he would ask wouldn't even respond to him or would say, no, they were too busy. Within a year, that would have changed a great deal. They would have been honored to be being asked by him to be in the issue. But the issue itself had a certain kind of edge to it. A number of people were kind of bemoaning the state of American fiction in particular and projecting certain things about the future. And at that time, and there was no reason to believe that this could happen, I really let the imagination go. And I started talking about books on demand and the possibility that one day you'd be able to run off books in your living room, that all books would be available via this instrument, which I really hardly familiar with at the time, the internet. And we'd be able to get all books, and all books would be permanently in print via electronic form, at least. I know a number of people, contacted me about it and said, this is absolutely crazy. This can't possibly happen. Then, of course, within X number of years, it has happened and goes on evolving. So, I mean, you're right in what you said earlier that it's, there's constant change that goes on in publishing. If anything, publishing is guilty of it's guilty of a lot of things, but one of them is the inability to adjust and change. Even though I have to hold a book in my hand to read it, I really am looking forward to the time in which almost everything is being done in ebook format, because I think there's so much more you can do with the book, such as adding on material, interviews with the writer, criticism. So that very thing that I was searching for with the review to create some small community of people who had this common interest. Well, you could almost do that within a book that you keep adding material onto, so you get to hear what other people have to say. And it's not necessarily an open forum. It is, you know, professional critics and writers.
Yeah. No, I think things. That vision, I think, although it's a side issue to what we were mainly planning to talk about, I think is very interesting. And that is, you know, I don't know whether you're familiar with Bob Stein and the Institute for the Future of the Book, but he's created, or they've created, a piece of software called Social Book, which does just what you're talking about, and that enables a book to become essentially a living conversation between the book and readers and themselves, and even the author and the readers and the book. I think that's a really powerful and somewhat neglected affordance that digital publishing enables. I think it's commercially, all of that's been ignored and really kind of dismissed as stuff that people are not interested in. But I think that in certain literary forms, there is this idea of changing the nature of the physicality of the book, I think is of interest. But so I'm glad to hear you talk about that. But we'll go back. I wanted to just talk a little bit about the internationalist kind of scope of both the review and the press. It seems to me that you've been more interested in and more engaged with international literature than almost anybody else that I can think of. And I kind of am interested in just how that came about. What is it that kind of drove you to look beyond the, the U.S. perhaps, and maybe even just England, to other countries?
There's many reasons for it. One, I was brought up, I started serious reading when I was a freshman in high school, and I began just reading everything I could get my hands on, with the guidance of a list of 100 books that a daring young teacher in high school, who was later fired for doing such things, gave me a list of 100 books to start with. And the first book on that list was Dostoevsky's The Idiot, 600 pages, I believe. So that's what I cut my teeth on in terms of serious reading. I started with Dostoevsky. And I read him as, you know, a novelist. I wasn't really aware of the translation part of it all. And proceeded probably a year to be reading an enormous amount of French literature in translation and Russian, and anything that it was being recommended to me, anything I'd read about in reviews. And it seemed to me that's the natural way of reading, is that you want to be reading everything that's available, because it all in some ways gets connected to each other. And to try to, or to be isolating a country or isolating a culture and focusing only on that, which is certainly what Americans tend to do, is not a way of reading literature. It's a means of something or other. But I think you have to see an international context if you're interested in literature. It would be odd, I think, to strike everybody as odd if we took music and we said there's only American music that is going to be available and talked about and taught. Some of this, too, is related to the academic system, where we have English departments. We don't have literature departments. So what do you do in an English department? You teach works written in English. There's almost no opportunity in colleges back when I was there, and I think it continues now, to take a course in which you're crossing countries, that you're looking at the novel as a form that it's irrelevant in some ways, that it's being that was written in different countries. It's let's say several writers who were trying to do something very similar, like Oli Poe writers in France. You have to read that in an international context, and in recent years, translation has become a very hot topic. And it's something that I used to write about, the problems that translators had. But there's a certain weirdness about this, that translations now seem to have become almost another genre rather than literature, that the issues of translation have gotten an enormous amount of attention. I think they should, but there's been at some expense to the book itself and to the writer, that the translator has become so much more prominent, and what the translator was up to in the book, that the original book and the original author begin to take a back seat to some of these things.
But of course, isn't it true? This has always struck me about translation, that let's presume one does not read the original language. So the translation is the only document that you have to go by. And there is no way to really decode the influence and effect of that particular translator's approach.
Right.
And so how do you deal with that? How does anyone deal with that? But how, again, on a sort of literary scale, because I think you're right that people have put translation into a box and it's a category of its own now rather than novel as novel. But isn't that partially because of the nature of translation itself, that it's not reliable on some level?
This is an issue we have to deal with on a very practical level. There was, within the last few years, two translators sent us samples from the same book that they were recommending to us to publish. And the translations took such different approaches that it wasn't as though you felt as though you're reading a different book, but you felt maybe that you're reading a rather different author. One was rather flamboyant interpretation of the book. The other was much more conventional. And it really brought my attention to, I think, an appropriate metaphor, that when you hear Beethoven, you realize it's the interpretation of a particular director, that you're certainly listening to Beethoven, but you're listening to Beethoven via someone's interpretation of how the music should be performed. I don't think we have an objection with that. I don't think we say, well, you know, this isn't really Beethoven. This is Vankarian's interpretation of his work. And I think that's the case with translation as well. What we finally look for, our standard at the press, is that a parallel experience is created via translation, so that people who are reading the book originally in, let's say, Spain, that it's very, very similar book that's being read now in English. In order to achieve this parallelism, oftentimes you have to be changing things that were in the original, because they had a basis in local references that get lost if you just duplicate them. So sometimes, and this will frequently be with the suggestions of the author, that problems such as that get rid of them, that and the authors will suggest ways of doing so. The authors always say, make it work in English. Translators have other kinds of goals associated with it, you know, the fidelity issue. But I've worked with authors on a translation in which there'll be a particular line, sometimes even a paragraph, that we'll be going over. And finally, the author will say, cut it. It's not a very good paragraph anyways. It doesn't contribute. Now, I've gotten into, you know, some strenuous battles with few translators as to whether the author has the right to do that. I'd say, well, of course he does. And the translators will say, no, that this has to be preserved as is, even if what you're talking about is an outright error, that the typographer decided what something was going to be saying, or that a poor editor, unfamiliar with a lot of the materials, just let them go. And now it's coming in, especially with something that's taking place in the United States and it's by a writer from another country. Little things will get in there where you know they're just not accurate. so that Connecticut is really not adjacent to Illinois, or at least not yet. Maybe it will be when the ocean melts. But you'll find mistakes, and I mean almost on that level, in the original. Can you change them? And that Fed tries to say, no, this is now. I think this is a comes out of a basic misunderstanding of that sacred original. You know, which original are you talking about? What a writer submitted to an editor in another country? Is that truly the sacred one? After it's been edited, does that now achieve its sacredness? And as I think both of us know, you go through a number, a generation of changes in hands, different hands are working on a manuscript. And one day you have to get it to the printer. It's got a deadline. So out it goes. Have it around for another 6 months, and there could be further changes with it. In that sense, the book is always is a work in progress. And I don't, in some ways, I feel uncomfortable with that idea. But it's a very different way of reading, I think, that's required. We accept that this is what it is now. It's a novel that you're reading. Does it work? And is it really capturing the spirit of the original? And if it's failing at that, if it's bad prose, and oftentimes you'll find that with translations, just bad prose. Well, no reader is going to be interested in bad prose. They wouldn't tolerate it with somebody writing in English, nor will they tolerate it with the translation. I don't think they should. I don't think there's a moral obligation that readers have to purchase translations, or once starting them, that they have to finish them. So you've got to achieve, which is what good translators do, you have to achieve a stylistic sophistication. And you also have to really get inside of the writer's head, oftentimes by asking the writer questions about the book, and come as close as possible to that original. But sometimes things just are not going to work in English, and best to get them out of the way, because for the original reader, they weren't problems. You know, if you have a list of cities, for instance, now this is one that I wouldn't violate, but the list of cities in Argentina, well, if you just literally translate it, and there may not be much of a context, you don't even know what the references are to. Is that the way it should be in terms of achieving fidelity? I don't think so. So you can add words like cities to it, and cities doesn't appear in the original because it would just be redundant in when it was published in Argentina. But there are other things that simply don't work. But what you can't do is make the kinds of substantial changes you might be recommending to an author who's writing a book in English, because it's not now finished. Whereas a translation really does. If a character dies, you can't bring him back to life via the translation. And sometimes you wish that you could. Or some novels have really bad last lines, and you'd like to change them. You may even know what the line should have been, but you can't do it. It is what it is. So you have all of these kinds of issues that come up in relation to translations, which wind up meaning that an editor has to spend about four times as much time on a translation as on a book written in English. And that usually is work that's not recognized by anybody. The translator just has to be quite satisfied that he or she did a good job, because nobody really, or it's rare that somebody will step forward and say, oh, it's such a brilliant editing job. Usually the fear, especially on the part of translators, is that you're going to be violating their translation. Whereas authors usually ask you, tell me what's wrong with the book. I want to know what's wrong. They may not agree with you in terms of what's wrong, but they want to hear it. Translators are up to something quite different, I think, and rarely are they asking for feedback about the translation, and sometimes they do not really want the feedback. They want you just to publish what they've submitted. So all this adds to the complications associated with translation, and as I say it with Dalkey, it's day-to-day kinds of issues that we have to be dealing with.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Dalkey Archive Press. I think that's a good point. What year did you start publishing books?
That was 1984, the first book came out.
And kind of what was the drive there? What was the impetus for you to move from doing the magazine to starting to publish books as well?
Well, part of it was purely delusional. I persuaded myself that doing some books, not very many, just a few, would not be much different from doing an extra issue of the Review of Contemporary Fiction. Now, I had to believe that in order to proceed. And, of course, it was completely different from doing an issue of the Review. And the particular mission at the beginning was to reprint books frequently by the writers who were being covered in the Review so that the books would be accessible. So here the Review is trying to create interest. But if the books aren't readily available, then what is the point? So the first book, the first issue of the Review was devoted to Gilbert Sorrentino. And the first book I reprinted was Splendide Hotel by Sorrentino. And there was another group, maybe half of them in the first two or three years, were ones that issues of the Review had been devoted to. But then there were other books that I was passionate about and had fallen into out of printdom. And so those got reprinted. And after about 3 years of this, I thought, okay, I have to get serious. I was just going to do one book, and that was it. And then a few others, then maybe a few others. You have to start planning. Well, what are you up to? Are you going to do original books? Because I was getting submissions from writers and translators. Do I want to do original books? Isn't enough just to be doing these reprints? But I wanted to do original books because some of them coming in were just spectacular books, and there was probably nobody else who was going to publish them. So, and those were the first few were from other countries, as well as at least one or two that were by Americans. And so I mean, my own beliefs about literature that should be read cross-country and cross-culturally came into play in terms of selecting the books. But I was trying to address that big problem of books being out of print and then realizing just how many books are out there being translated and writers, who were perhaps no translators even discovered them yet, were extraordinary writers, but they weren't getting into English. And if not getting into English, they had problems getting into other languages as well. English, of course, is the language that, especially in publishing, everybody knows, and they can make judgments on the book based upon an English edition. And that happens quite frequently, that some of these writers from other countries who have never had anything translated before into another country, when our edition comes out, several publishers will then pick it up and do an edition in their countries. And it's over this issue that they can read the entire book. We don't benefit from this. The original publisher, the author, holds the rights. But it's part of the service, I hope, that Dahlke represents to create the audience for writers and to have them reach as many people as possible.
So can you, who would be some of the writers that you feel like your work has done? Now it's been 30 years you've been publishing books, but if you could name some, I know that it's kind of unfair to ask this out of the many that you've done, but of those that you've published, do you feel like there are some in particular that because of the work that you did to introduce them to readers or to bring them back to readers after having been neglected, that have stood out, that your effort has had a particular impact on those writers' readership in America?
I can point to a few instances of it. And I should say that with the writers we publish, oftentimes, I don't judge how well the book sells the first year or 2 years. We do have this policy that I've followed from the start that we keep books in print permanently and have managed to do it. the now that policy was established before there were many books. Now that there are over 700 of them, you run into problems and expenses with warehousing. And if you change distributors, you have to ship all those books across country. So it's a rather expensive, noble principle that the presses had from the beginning. But writers that have benefited in some dramatic way, I think, I usually just say it's the writers. They deserve all the credit. But, you know, in some cases, I'll say, okay, all right, yes, the publisher had something to do with this. Flann O'Brien is a case in point. We had done several of his books, but his two major books are At Swim Two Birds and The Third Policeman. And his agent, who was one of the old-timers, Carl Brandt, called me one day and he said, the lease is up with Penguin for these books. And he said, I can get a lot more money from Penguin than I can get from you. And he was quite right. But I know you're going to be serious about the books and you're going to do a better job with them than Penguin does. So he accepted our modest terms. And we came out with both of those books. Both of them now are well over 50,000 copies that have been sold. He's a major figure for us. And we don't measure major based upon how many copies is a writer selling. But Flann O'Brien, since the press was named after one of his books, is one of the key writers for us. And he has benefited. Another one, and I'll push this off on the author, that the author says this, is William Gass. The Tunnel. The Tunnel came out from Knopf and was in print for a year. Then, for some reason that has always rather mystified me, HarperCollins did a paperback of it, and they kept it in print. For listeners, it's instructive to say it's a very, very long book and a rather difficult and complicated book, a masterpiece, but it's not for casual reading or bedtime reading. And that has sold quite well for us. I think we're in the third printing, and of course publishers hate having to go back to press with long, long books, which are going to create a big, big expense from the printer. But we, I think, are in the third printing of The Tunnel, and have a hard time keeping it available. We must be up to like 8,000-9,000 copies that it is now sold, which still is a small number when you're talking about a commercial novel. But in terms of a writer such as Gass, it's a great number. And it's something he's recognized about all the books of his that we've done, that they were failing in the marketplace. And we take them on and actually achieve numbers that are very decent numbers. There's an illusion, I think, out there that if a large commercial publisher does a writer that otherwise might appear on our list, that they'll do so much better with them in terms of sales. And there's one commercial house in particular that we frequently will buy rights from to do a paperback edition, cloth edition. And they'll give us the real numbers for sales. And it's really shocking sometimes with writers to see how did they sell. The commercial publishers are able to get more reviews than we can get, which then even kind of is mystifying all the more that with all of these reviews, and oftentimes, rave reviews, still the numbers are so small. And I think that says something about how small the literary culture is in the States. And I don't see anything wrong with that. I'm not dismayed by it. I think it's perhaps an inevitability. James Lachlan, the publisher of New Directions, he and I started corresponding at the end of his life. And my two models in publishing were New Directions and Barney Rossett's Grove Press. Had they not existed, I don't think I ever would have even thought of doing Dalkey. They were the ones I imitated, and I made it quite well known that imitated them in terms of paying homage to them. So Lachlan and I started corresponding, and I wrote to him at some point and said, I think the audience out there in the entire country is 50,000. It doesn't mean you'll reach all of them with every book or that they'll even like every book, but the potential audience is 50,000. And he wrote back and he said, that's what it was in the 1930s. It's 30,000 now. So typical publisher kind of tracking this number that can't really be gotten at accurately. But he thought that it had shrunk, and it may well have. I know that we have very dedicated readers. And during the recession, recent recession, our sales didn't drop. Now, we may have been causing problems for people who had difficulty buying the books, that they couldn't afford them. But our sales stayed the same. And I get a lot of letters and emails from people who will talk, say how important the press has been to them. And they'll cite specific books, but that it's really affected their lives. Oftentimes it'll be writers who are saying that without Dahlke, and the authors we publish and the authors they read, they probably wouldn't be writers, that they've been inspired by this. I was telling somebody today, the Irish Times was interviewing me for something, and I said that at a party at the London Book Fair a few years ago, there was a small, intimate kind of gathering that a French publisher had called. And as I was leaving, another publisher was coming in. And when she was introduced to me, she said, oh, you have no idea how much Dahlke has meant to me over the years. You're the reason that my press was founded, and I owe so much to you. Now, as you well know, in the small press world, no matter how long you've been around, you still think of it in its very origins, that you watch every penny that's being spent, and you imagine the garage or the basement or wherever you were starting it is still really where you are. Now, reality can be quite different from that. So hearing this, I mean, it was very pleasant to hear, but it was also a little bit of a shock that that Dahlke was having this effect. And I guess I can see it with a number of publishers in the last maybe 10 years that have come along. They're doing something very similar to what we've been doing for years, and especially in the area of translation. And that's nice. I would have thought, going back about 10 years, that it would be impossible to start Dahlke all over again, that the distribution system and discounting and so on had become so complicated that it really wouldn't be possible to start a press. But they're starting all the time, and very small, semi-small. And that's, it's nice. What Lachlan and Barney Ross did for me, apparently Dahlke has done it for a number of other people. And it's nice to see that within publishing, that kind of spirit still exists, that what you do for authors also at some point can have a big influence on publishers.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Model.
Yeah. Well, and I think also what you're observing is that for someone starting today, their world is this world, and they don't, they don't, it is what they are the kind of cards that are dealt. So it is no more difficult for them to start. It's just different. And they do have then other models to look at. I was going to ask you, actually, it's really nice you brought that up. Which publishers today, new ones in particular, do you think are carrying ahead the kind of same, the kind of creative and subversive work that you've been interested in?
Oh, there's really so many of them. I'm afraid to even mention any for fear of excluding. Archipelago has certainly been one of those presses. And Jill Schulman, when she started it, did a tour of the presses. She went up to Minneapolis to talk to Coffee House and Grey Wolf, and then came to Normal, Illinois to talk to me. she was doing something that none of us had done, and that is think about it before doing your first book, plan it. People, especially in the small presses, the founders just want to do it, get it out, and they consider marketing down the road somewhere, fundraising down the road. It's the book that matters to them, and only the book. So that's a press that I think has been doing really good work. New York Review Books, even though they're technically one of our competitors, especially in the area of reprints that they do, we overlap rather frequently with each other. I think is extraordinary list that they've developed. There's a new press in Texas called Blue Vellum, which I haven't met anybody from there, but and I think it's a one-man operation right now, doing maybe 4 to 6 books a year. And he's doing all the right books. I mean, the right authors and the right books. And there he is, I assume a young guy who's started it. But then I hear almost, it's not a daily basis, but it might be a weekly basis of somebody's referring to another new press. I've stopped following presses, any presses, and it's strange that I have. I used to follow them as presses to see what they were up to and how they were changing. For reasons I'm not sure what they are, I just pay less attention to what other presses are doing these days. Or I'll pay attention to some of the books that are coming out, but just less attention to who they are. I think it could be a generational thing that the people in publishing that I kind of grew up with and old with, were people from Curbstone and Coffee House and Copper Canyon. And that's my generation of friends and we kind of share a history, and others are publical. It's a shared history. We've had similar histories. And, of course, Douglas Messerly, who's also a dear friend. So it's nice, to see all these presses springing up. But I don't have much to do with them. And maybe it's just that there's not the forum in which it's easy to get to know them. Because the what was referred to as the Mellon Nine, the Mellon Foundation, funded 9 of the presses for a period, I think it was 7 years. And they required that we come to meetings. And that's really how we got to know each other. You would think that Gray Wolf and Dahlke would have known each other already now in Coffee House. Never had anything to do with Alan. Even Sun and Moon, it was the first time that I met Douglas in person. We'd exchanged a few letters, but it was, the Mellons insisting upon these meetings that we all kind of got to know each other and to some degree got to know about how the others operated. Although small presses are very, very protective of information. Unfortunately, many times they see other small presses as their competitors rather than colleagues and collaborators. And there have been attempts over the years for us to do something as a group, but always would kind of fall apart on the issue of, are you going to share your information? And it's much easier getting an answer out of Random House, an accurate answer. And how many copies did such and such sell? Then it is, my friends whose numbers seem to grow as a conversation goes on. As we're speaking, another 1,000 copies just got sold. And that makes it difficult. It would be nice if everybody could share information. There's a lot, after all these years, that we could learn from each other. The great exception of that was Curbstone, and I know you knew Sandy quite well and know Judy. They're always an open press and always making information available. Even though they had one agenda, which was political, and I had my aesthetic agenda, we did some of the same authors, and they used to refer to me as elitist, and I'd refer to them as radicals who were trying to undermine the country. Out of all this over the years, we became close friends, and we could share. Because some of it, you know, becomes embarrassing. Like, how many copies did you sell of this book? You know, it's not something you want to be bragging about. But it's too bad that there's not more of that among the small presses. It would help us all, but it doesn't really exist.
No, that's probably true. Well, let's talk just, we have a little bit of time left, and I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about the kind of the structural issues. And, you know, you've touched upon that a little bit here in terms of the kind of community of publishers. And I think most of you as a group became nonprofits at a certain point. You've been housed at academic institutions. I think you were, you were at University of Illinois for quite a while, but now you're in Texas,
yes.
Housed at the University of Houston at Victoria. How does that work, you know, in terms of, you know, just for those who may not understand what a press and magazine do when they're part of a larger academic institution? How does that work for you?
It's maybe one or two other presses have had this over the years.
Well, Arte Publico, who you mentioned, is at is at Houston, and Nicholas Canellos has been, and I've talked to him. He's another interviewee of mine and an old friend. He's been at the University of Houston for, it seems like, forever. So there certainly are other examples.
Well, in that case, I believe the University of Houston owns Arte Publico, whereas we maintain our legal independence from the university. That difference can be significant at times. Namely, the University of Houston is responsible for putting up the money that's necessary for it, whereas our relationship with the universities, which has really been quite good over the years, they support us. They, especially University of Houston, Victoria has been very generous in supporting what we're doing. And that does mean that, you know, cash or monetary support, but also office space, warehousing space, and some of the infrastructural things that are available at the university that presses, let's say, do not excel at. Bookkeeping can be among them. Also, the advice and the help you can get from various offices at a university. And this situation so far has just been extraordinarily good. But it's difficult. You would think there would be a natural collaboration going on between nonprofits, literary nonprofits, and universities, because one has something to offer that the other doesn't have. So many universities don't have, for instance, a press. And certainly don't have a literary press. So a lot can be offered both, you know, in terms of monetary support and space and somebody to empty the waste paper baskets. But the bureaucracy that exists at universities flies in the face of the entrepreneurial methods, especially of the founders. But I think maybe it characterizes small press world generally. They do things on instinct. They believe in their instincts. They aren't great at planning. They get very involved in what they're doing today and forget about what's coming up tomorrow. The universities, of course, are, you know, these creatures that tend to be very slow to act. If you make a suggestion to, well, universities I've been at, they won't start paying attention until you tell them that some other university is already doing it. In other words, that introducing new ideas can be very, very time-consuming and frequently will fail if they really are new ideas. You think that they'd love such things, but they don't. So what should be a natural collaboration is actually problematic and can easily become problematic. Still, there should be, and we once applied for a grant to do this, to do a study when we moved to the University of Illinois, to do a study of, you know, 4 or 5 years tracing What are the issues? What are the problems? How did they get solved or didn't they get solved? So that that would be available to people who are, well, the presses that are trying to establish a relationship with universities. Because you have to be, the presses have to be very careful. Are they getting what they need? And what assurances do they have? Robert Creeley has popped up in my life a few times. Once was as we were about to move to Illinois State University. He just happened to be giving a reading when I was down there for a few days. And I had to introduce myself. We had not met before. And he said to me, I hear that you might be coming here. Realize this, that whatever they give you, they'll start taking it away as soon as you get here.
Yeah.
So make sure you get everything that you want. That was his advice. Then when he was at Brown, and I can tell this story since Bob is now deceased, it was a time in which Brown University was trying to get us to move there. And or a number of people in the faculty were. And there was a little party at Bob Coover's house, and Bob Creeley was teaching there then. And he pulled me aside before we sat down for dinner. And he said, now, I hear tomorrow you're meeting with the provost. Here's what you should do. If you find him asking you to justify why Brown should bring you here, leave the room. And it almost happened verbatim with the, how he described it. At some point, as we were meeting with the provost, who was going to be making the decision, he said to me, why should we want you to come here? It's a very strange question. You know, you're invited to come out to talk to them about coming there. Now they're asking you to explain why they should do this. And I said to him, because of what Creeley had said to me, I said to him, I think that's really, you know, what you're supposed to be deciding, not be asking me this question. Another question he also asked was, well, what happens if Dahlke goes bankrupt? Well, what's going to, happen with bills and obligations? And what he was worried about is that they would wind up being on the desk, his desk, of the university. And I said to him, well, what happens if you go bankrupt? Where does that leave us? I said, we've been running a surplus every year. I don't know whether you have. He didn't like it. But I knew it was hopeless by that point when he's asking those kinds of aggressive questions. And so it turned out to be Bob Coover has tried at least two or three times to make this happen. It was a logical place. I think it's the only real creative writing program in the country that offers this emphasis on alternative writing. And they have some very good people teaching there.
Yeah, the Waldrops are there.
Yes, the Waldrops. So many writers, a few of them are writers. It was kind of unfortunate at the time that they had the provost that they did. So these relationships, I think, could be incredibly valuable to the small press world, which is always struggling to stay afloat because there can be money support. And then, as I say, certain infrastructural expenses that you just hate paying, the light bill, if the air conditioning goes out, it's your expense. And those are the kinds of things that universities just can do without even thinking about them. They pick up those kinds of expenses. And so it's difficult. I can assure you it's difficult. Once you have a change of administrators, for instance, a whole new crew comes in and they can start wondering, why is this nonprofit here on this campus? Is it costing us money? So that's when the problems can start happening. Houston is a very different kind of setup. It's a small school that wants to get larger, but modestly so larger. And they've been trying to create unique programs that they're really taking risks. We're going to do what others haven't and then make those programs the best in the country. So that's what they want to be doing with translations, but also their creative writing program and their publishing program. So it's been It's been very beneficial and filled with promises and hopes for the future.
So I guess one last subject to talk about is, you know, and you've touched on this again, you've kind of prompted this question. And I know you've begun an effort to form an endowment, thinking about Dahlke and Review of Contemporary Fiction as, protecting them for the long future. And I think that's unusual for most literary organizations. It's not just that it's that they don't have them. It's that it's so difficult to create an endowment. Did you feel that is critical for Dahlke to have going forward? Is that something that you're putting a lot of energy and effort into? And how does that look right now?
To answer your last question first, rot with problems is what it looks like right now. But that's part of the reason for moving to the University of Houston. It's part of our agreement that there's going to be active support on the part of the university to help raise such an endowment. This is a discussion that goes back years and years, both among some of my fellow publishers and also with consultants and so on. And that is an endowment necessary? Why don't you just raise an extra few $100,000 each year, and won't that take care of? Well, yeah, until you hit the bad year or the bad 2 years. And there are certain things that can happen in publishing, especially nonprofit publishing, that can be fatal. That if you have, you know, the perfect storm occur, if your distributor goes out of business, if your National Endowment for the Arts grant doesn't come through 1 year, although that's become less and less of a significant grant to us. So granting the donations, if they for some reason drop, if a key staff person leaves, which may be the reason why some of these other problems start happening, that can really sink you rather quickly. It's easy to lose a lot of money in publishing. And the issue is, should this go on? It's an argument that Douglas Misterly, you know, Sun and Moon and now Green Integer, used to have. He thought that it should, his press should end when he did. And my view was, no, I don't want this to be what my 35 years or however many more years I have to end with, that it was all kind of about me and it's going to come to an end. We really have built, you know, a rather substantial list, and authors turn to us for help, and especially keeping their books in print. I don't think that should end because I end. It's become an institution. And at some point, if you're talking about an endowment and you've been around for 7 or 8 years, well, that's rather silly. You haven't demonstrated the need for this to be kept in existence. Whereas I think, and it's hard for me to get an accurate view, try to look at the press from the outside and while I'm on the inside, but I think Dahlke and its mission are something that should be preserved. And the only thing that's really going to protect it ultimately is a financial base, that if somebody key leaves and you have one or two of these other things happen, that you really could afford to say, we should take some time off and plan. How are we going to respond to this? How are we going to find a replacement for this key person? Because ultimately that affects, if you don't have that luxury, it's going to affect the quality of what you're doing, and the authors are going to suffer as a result. So that's guaranteed money, more or less, coming in every year that, you know, could perhaps not be coming in via grants and individual donations. It's critical that you get this philanthropic support from the outside world, but we've come close to it at times of having a perfect storm and have been able to survive it. But after I'm gone, the founders are very peculiar people. They can do a lot of different things, not all of them very well. But they bring together, mind for business, and then they have the aesthetic taste that drives them in terms of what books are going to be published. They understand marketing, even if they're not very good at it. They bring all these things together, and there's no way you're going to replace that founder in coming in with the same kind of knowledge and also an ability to survive. Founders are very good at that. So once the founder is gone, an organization is going to have some real issues facing it. If you have that money to be falling back on, that's you can do it in a very smart way. Otherwise, you're just trying to find solutions overnight, and oftentimes those are not the best ones. So without that endowment, I think that it's going to be very difficult. We will be going year to year in terms of donated support. But I think we're at the point in which this has become a valuable institution. And I'm not saying it just because it's what I started. I think it has become this. And it should go on. It shouldn't be just dependent upon me. But that requires some number of people, and I think it would be people, not corporations or foundations, who think it also is that important. And we have some rather startling examples of major donations being made by individuals in the U.S. to endow, presses or a magazine, two magazines, as a matter of fact. It's just that so many people are unaware of the fact that there is a nonprofit sector. And, oftentimes, if you're talking to people asking them to contribute support, they'll say, well, why don't you do more popular books? Maybe if you did some bestsellers, then you wouldn't need to. Well, yeah, if you become something else, then maybe you don't need to, but then what's the point of it all? So are there those people out there? And what am I talking about? 3 or 4 or 5, at most 15 people who are in a position to make such a contribution, and that it's important to them that the press survives. That's really the big issue that we're facing. So as long as I'm still kicking, there's, I'm of value to the press and can get us through various storms. But I won't be. My guess is 3 to 5 years. It's what I've told the University of Houston. But on some days, I certainly feel like I wish it were sooner. There are other things that at a certain age you begin to enjoy and you'd like to do more of. Those things aren't quite available to me now. So that's the issue facing us, and it's what the future's all about. And I just have this blind confidence that those people for whom the press means something, or that literature means something, are going to be there over the next few years, and that we will achieve the endowment.
Well, I hope that does happen. Thank you, John. This has been an amazing conversation. I really appreciate your taking the time to speak so thoughtfully about Dahlke Archive Press and Review of Contemporary Fiction.
Well, thank you, David, and thank you for all of your past wisdom. And you really are one of these remarkable people in the small press world that made a great deal of difference to us all. And that you're certainly a part of the history of all this if somebody ever gets around to writing about it. So thank you for that, and thank you for today. It was great fun talking to you.
Yeah, my pleasure. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to John O'Brien about Review of Contemporary Fiction and Dahlke Archive Press.